Welcome to MoneyWeb Now. Business news every morning.
It's Monday, 22nd June. I'm Simon Brown, coming you live and loud from Johannesburg, South Africa, where the days are now starting to get longer. On the show this morning, Nick Kuntz, iron ore flying and Chinese online retail giants, Jean-Pierre Fester on how investors should be thinking about the spate of rights issues on the JSE, with undoubtedly more to come. And then Renergen on the liquid natural gas network they're rolling out and their helium deposits. Some morning headlines from MoneyWeb: deficit seen widest since World War I, weighing on South African bonds. And then Reuters: Wirecard says missing $2.1 billion likely does not exist and withdraws results. Wirecard, go check up on that story. It is a wild story. Morning markets. On Friday, we saw the S&P off 0.6% and the Nasdaq literally a couple of points into the green. Asia, green this morning. Sydney up 0.4%. Turkey up 0.2%. Commodities, mostly green across the board. ZAR, 17.36. And top 40 opening call, slightly green this morning.
MoneyWeb Now, on the money. Also available on podcast.
Chatting with Nick Kuntz, he's a portfolio manager at Sanlam Private Wealth. Nick, morning, appreciate your time. I want to kick off with iron ore. Commodities have been, broadly, they've been holding up fairly well during the pandemic, I imagine in part simply due to supply issues. Iron ore been way more than holding up. It's been flying and Kumba Iron Ore going along with it.
Yeah, Simon, good morning. Yeah, very much so. It's interesting. Iron ore always one of those sort of commodities that's never really on the forefront of investors' minds. We always tend to talk about, you know, the price of oil and mm-hmm. gold and platinum, but iron ore has gone from being one of these sort of prices that was set in these smoky back rooms in China once a month. It's now the most second most traded commodity in the world behind oil. And, of course, I think a lot of that's to do with the fact that Dalian Exchange is such an active contract, and, of course, Singapore as well. So you get a futures price in both, which always is sort of allowed speculators to come in. But, yeah, it's been an absolute charge. I mean, as of the last, 8 weeks up in a row now. 9 weeks up in a row now. And then this morning it's taking a little bit of a breather. But, definitely benefiting the likes of Kumba and our local iron ore producers.
And I suppose part of the story, apart from it just potentially speculators, is that if mm-hmm. we're going to see massive infrastructure spend as a result of the pandemic, and most countries are talking about it, the US is talking $1 trillion, steel's a big part of that, and iron ore goes into steel. So, I mean, it might actually have some proper sort of, you know, underpinning to the move.
No, massively. You know, the iron ore is one of the main ingredients when it comes, as you said, to construction. It's used in with rolled, I think hot steel is another contract that's traded, and the steel rebar, which is another one. All these components add up into the construction industry, and a big demand. And it's closely watched in the Far East. They tend to look at a lot of things on the sort of what they call the sort of like coast side. Same as they count the sort of the numbers in the warehouse in London, the same is done in China, and it's closely watched. But by all intents and purposes, there's still a bit of a deficit in China. So hence the stockpiling of the Chinese, and hence the iron ore price pushing up.
Okay.
Also, incidentally, you can actually overlay a chart of the Baltic Dry Index, which is obviously your movements of shipping and freights with the iron ore the last 8 weeks, and it's almost tick for tick. The Baltic Dry had the biggest uptick, I think, on Thursday or Friday, up almost 30% on the day. So lots happening in the background.
Okay, there's a fascinating factoid I'll do shortly. Something that caught my mind on, it was late Thursday, JD Group, Alibaba, obviously big Chinese online retailers, they manufactured a make-believe event for the 18th of June. No reason behind it. I think it's JD.com's birthday. They clocked up $136 billion in sales on Thursday. We all focus on Amazon, but there are some online retail giants in China, and should we perhaps giving a little more attention to them?
Definitely. definitely. I mean, these are potential stocks that are benefiting in this pandemic, if you could call it, these lockdown shares that are actually increasing revenue as people convert more to sort of online and the working from home space. I mean, you name JD Group. I mean, Alibaba is another one. Mm-hmm. A couple of these. The problem is I've got is from an investor's point of view, there's a little bit of problems with listing in America at the moment. There's a little bit of anti-Chinese sentiment. You saw JD Group relisted now back into Hong Kong. I think you might have more and more heading that way. But definitely, I mean, you've got that is where sort of, I guess, a lot of the growth is going to come until we get back to normal, and you should not ignore those shares at any cost.
Yeah, and I mean, we're seeing it. I mean, I was having a look over the weekend. You know, another day where there's a disconnect between the Nasdaq and the S&P, and not massive, but yeah, you know, the Nasdaq keeps ticking higher, maybe only a couple of points. The S&P seems to be struggling a bit, and that's that tech disconnect, because the Nasdaq, it's not exclusively tech stocks, but it has obviously a lot of tech in it, and that's what the market is buying.
Definitely. And in fact, if those are listening to the show, watch out for Friday. Friday is actually the reweighting of the Russell Index in the US, which is just sort of small to medium cap shares. It's probably a better barometer of where the market is. We tend to always look at the S&P, but the Russell is actually probably a better one. They're reweighting it once a year. It's usually the biggest volume of the year on that day. And interesting enough, names that people are familiar with, Zoom, which you all use at home now, Slack, another one, all possibly going into that index, as you said, rightly so, that consumer habits are changing, those shares are changing, and those tech shares are the ones that tend to bring us higher. So interesting enough that Russell, which traditionally was, I guess, sort of small place America, now becoming more of a tech flavor. So tying in exactly what you said, Simon.
Yeah, that I'm going to be watching that Russell rebalancing. Apparently a lot of healthcare and a lot of tech going into that index. That's where it is these days. And as Nick says, the Russell only balances once a year. It's not quarterly like our indices here. That's Nick Kuntz, Portfolio Manager, Sanlam Private Wealth. Appreciate your time this morning, sir.
Business, finance and investment news. MoneyWeb Now.
With Simon Brown.
On the Money. Also available on podcast.
Chatting with Jean-Pierre Fester. He is the CEO at Protea Capital Management. Jean-Pierre, appreciate your time. We're seeing, I don't know if we can call it a flood, but certainly a bunch of capital raising on the JSE. We saw Transaction Capital do a book build. We've got the Ficini Group, Coro, Sun International talking rights issues. Mr. Price also looking potentially at a rights issue as well. Is this, I mean, what are we as investors to make about it? Is this boards being extra cautious? Is it boards truly being worried about debt burdens in the next 6, 12, 18 months?
Hi, Simon. Yes, it's probably a bit of everything you've mentioned. So there are companies like Mr. Price, which seems to have a strong balance sheet, but still decided to do a significant rights issue. And then there are companies like Sun International, who clearly have got a stretched balance sheet even before COVID. And then because of the lockdown and not being able to open their casinos, being in a very delicate situation at the moment. So it's not all because of financial stress, but it's also not all to be proactive and just to be in a strong position. It's a bit of a mix of both. But it's definitely not the last, I think, of the rights issues. If you think about still the discrepancy, in my opinion, regarding prices and the reality that companies are seeing, I can understand that management teams are looking at their management budgets and reports of, say, a monthly profit and loss, and then looking at the share price and saying, my goodness, if my share price is not reflecting the real world, let me raise capital.
That's a great point, because we look at a share price and, you know, Mr. Price, even a Transaction Capital, they're off the highs. But that's the wrong way to look at it. Rather look at the underlying business relative to the current share price. And that stretch has perhaps stretched a bit. And therefore, this is an opportune moment, particularly if we're going to see a lot more coming. You might want to get in sooner rather than later. Or is that perhaps a bit of a weird concept?
No, I think that's quite right. Because these companies are tapping the pockets of shareholders, it's not an infinite resource. Mm-hmm. At some point, shareholders are going to say, okay, listen, we've supported so many rights issues now. Our equity allocation in our funds are high enough. We're not going to put more money in. So companies that might even think that they don't need a rights issue right now, but they might need one in 6 or 9 months' time, might say, if we don't get near the front of the queue right now, there might not be any money left in our shoulders as pockets for us to do it later. And that is why it's an interesting, almost game theory also playing out, where a lot of companies are saying, well, maybe I need it, maybe I don't. But if I can get my hands on that money and it means one of my competitors might be in a weaker position, can't, then it actually puts me in a competitive advantage. And I think in the clothing retail sector, that might be the case. And that's an interesting dynamic also playing out.
I hadn't thought of that. It's actually looking over the fence at your competitor at the same time. The one thing that bothers me, debt is at the moment incredibly cheap. So you know, and maybe it's difficult to get hold of, but rates around the world and in South Africa are quite low. A rights issue, because you issue new shares, that's a perpetual, you know, lifelong claim to future profits. I would have thought perhaps debt is better. Or is this because a rights issue is unencumbered? You don't have to pay it back.
Exactly. So for those who can take on debt, that would be the preferred method of financing because of the low interest rates at the moment. But yeah, the problem is that a lot of companies already have got stretched balance sheets. So the bankers are telling them, sorry, we're not going to lend you any further money. And you see that principally in the property sector, where the share prices in the property sector are very low at the moment, significantly below NAV of a lot of these property companies. But because the property companies have already borrowed so much in the past, and some of them also unfortunately even locked in their floating rate debt at fixed rates in the past, which means they don't benefit from the lower rates, they are still paying the higher fixed rate that they hedged. It means that some companies don't have the luxury to borrow money at the current low rates. The bankers won't allow it, and therefore they have to go to equity markets. And as you say, that is perpetual. Equity is going to dilute current shareholders in perpetuity. So shareholders, if they have the cash, should follow their rights. And those who don't might be diluted quite significantly.
Yeah, and that following your rights, I mean, I imagine it would be a case by case. Although, if you're invested in the company, if you don't want to be diluted, you do then need to follow those rights rather than sell them on, which you can in most cases do, but probably not a good idea. You're in the stock, you like it, keep your slice of the pie, so to speak.
Yes, if you already now think that the capital that will be raised by the company is not sufficient, and I think in the case of, say, Sun International, there's a risk of that happening, then it would make sense to rather sell your shares right now. And if you do hold the shares at the time that you receive rights, then you should follow them, because otherwise you're just throwing money into the water if you get your rights but you don't exercise them. And you can try and sell them, but quite often the market for rights isn't as liquid as the market for the actual share, and therefore you often don't get a lot of value for rights if you try to sell them. So make the decision now and decide which of these companies are doing rights issues to strengthen their competitive position, and those are probably the good ones to follow, but which companies are raising capital out of a weak position, and the capital might not be sufficient. They might fall back into a weaker balance sheet a year from now if the operations are still significantly impacted. And those ones you should seriously consider selling right now rather than holding on till the rights issue and only then not following your rights.
Yeah, and then there might be a second and third. I think that's a great point. Rather exit ahead. The price might not be great, but it can get a lot worse and it can cost you a lot more. Jean-Pierre Fester, CEO at Protea Capital Management. Jean-Pierre, always appreciate your time.
MoneyWeb now on the money. Also available on podcast.
Chatting with Stefano Marani. He's a Renogen CEO. Stefano, appreciate your time this morning. Some sense coming out last week and a press release. I saw your liquid natural gas replacement for diesel. I want to touch on the total deal, but first let's get a sense of liquid natural gas. In essence, this is looking at transport haulers and getting them to switch from diesel to what I imagine is a cleaner and perhaps cheaper and lower maintenance cost product for their long-haul trucks.
Good morning. Yes, you're absolutely right, Simon, and thank you for having me. So the use of natural gas in trucks and, in fact, any combustion engine is not new. It's been around since before World War II, actually.
Okay.
And there are about 24 million vehicles globally that run on gas. The way to get a truck to run on it, there's one of two ways. Big brands like Scania, Iveco, Volvo, they all sell off-the-shelf LNG trucks, doing very well in Europe and in China and the US at the moment. and now they're starting to introduce in South Africa. Alternatively, there are a few highly respected kits out there from Italy and the Netherlands, and you can retrofit the truck for probably about a 10 to 12 month payback, and then you can get the truck to run on energy. But as you pointed out, but with the right technology, you can reduce your greenhouse gas emissions by up to 90%.
Wow. Okay. That's significant, and you know, particularly in an ESG world, environmental, social, and governance, that's a biggie. And you talk around a payback of around 12 months. Is it a long term cost saving for a company if they do the transition as well?
So the cost savings are very significant. I mean, you'll know full well that these logistics companies operate on very thin margins.
Yeah.
So you change your truck, you retrofit, and you get it to run on gas. You're probably saving anywhere from around 25 to 28% of your fuel cost by doing the conversion.
Okay, that's chunky.
Yeah, I mean, that basically means that you're more than doubling the net profit before tax per truck mm-hmm. that you convert.
And then the issue is, and this was your announcement of I think it was Friday morning, where you're going to be tying up with Total, and you're going to be starting to create a network. N3 initially, it'll be up and running by third quarter of next year, so that the truckers can essentially know that between Joburg and Durban, they can move up and down that route and refuel as and when they need at certain stations. But they've got that, you know, they don't have to worry about sort of range phobia we get with electric vehicles.
Correct. So right now, our first phase will only have limited supply. So it's first come, first served, and we're only selling to customers that have signed up contracts with us.
Mm-hmm.
And these include the likes of Anheuser-Busch, Black Knight, BHIT, and the likes. We're also negotiating with a few more trucking companies, but we'll have our first phase of gas wrapped up. Second phase will come online probably around 2023, and that'll see significantly more supply coming online. So it'll be a little bit more open. But yes, I mean, the tie-up with Total may complete that for two reasons. Firstly, we're very much aligned in terms of strategy. They also want to go carbon neutral by, within a certain amount of time. I believe their target is 2050.
Mm-hmm.
And they're probably one of the world's largest suppliers of LNG. And to boot, they've got 700 LNG filling stations across the world. So they know what they're doing. The second reason for the tie-up with Total is they really do have some libations, fights when it comes to locations. So from our perspective, yeah, getting access to real estate to be able to put our infrastructure down and dispense from those two sites made perfect sense.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's an infrastructure story as well. Let's quickly pivot for a moment. Helium. I know you've got a helium deposit in the Free State. I know I came across helium. I think it was Party Shack in the US had a bad year because they literally didn't have enough helium for their helium balloons. And it just, I mean, I'll be honest, it blew my mind a bit. I did some digging. This is a greenfields operation. It's early-ish days, but you're moving forward to produce helium out of the Free State.
So you couldn't find an author that would be creative enough to write a helium story. It's absolutely crazy. I like to think of Renogen as being here to keep the party going because we do have a helium crisis at the moment. The shortage is deep and profound. The main uses for helium are in the medical space.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't manufacture nor can you run MRIs and CAT scans without helium. But then it's also used in a bunch of cool stuff like rocket launches, putting satellites in space.
Yeah.
You can't manufacture cell phones, TVs, computers, microchips without helium, and there is no substitute. So, I mean, you take helium out of the equation, and the world becomes a very, very different place with a lot of the technology that we live and rely on today having, you know, just basically disappeared. Now, more importantly, there's also a more recent use discovered for helium, and that's in the respirators for COVID sufferers.
Mm-hmm.
They found that by inclusion of helium into the mix, the patient has a much better prospect of survival. So it really is a critical element. In terms of our project, we're pleased to say we have the world's highest concentration with our last well clocking in at 12%. I mean, you put that in context, the world average is 0.5%.
And that is greenfield. So what sort of timeline to production?
It comes online. It's part of the process of the manufacture of the LNG.
Okay.
Rather, the LNG is rather a part of the process of manufacturing the helium.
Okay, so a couple of years. We'll leave that there. And go dig around helium, as Stefano says. It's an amazing story. The U.S. strategic reserves and then not strategic. It's also a finite reserve. And there are the locations where it pops up in the world. It is a movie waiting to be made. Stefano Marani from CEO of Renergen. Appreciate your time. That's it for today. You'll find us live every weekday morning, 6:30 on moneyweb.co.za or the MoneyWeb app. Podcast from 7 a.m. Chat to us on the Twitter, on the Facebook, hashtag MoneyWeb now. My thanks to you for listening. My guests, my producer, Koldora, and sound engineer, Eddie. My name is Simon Brown. This is MoneyWeb now. We'll chat again tomorrow.